I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance, Tuesday, March 15, 2005. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Cornish?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Metzl? Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamer?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Here.
We do have a quorum present, so we'll first go to the minutes of the meeting of March 10, 2005. They are in the packet. Is there any questions or discussion? Is there a motion? Representative Cornish moves approval of those minutes. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. At this time, we'll take up House File 963, Smith, Strangulation of Family or Household Member. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir.
Do you want to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 963 that it be recommended to pass and that it be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
And the motion, the bill is before us. I understand you have an amendment.
I'd like to walk through the bill and refer to the amendment. Then I'd like to ask Mr. Carlson to perhaps describe the amendment. And then we do have, I think, three, perhaps four testifiers standing by that we can offer if the committee so desires, but we would be prepared to go ahead with discussion after presentation.
Do you want to incorporate the amendment before the discussion?
No, I'll present it separately because okay. It's a larger than just an insignificant amendment.
Okay.
Relative to the bill, Mr. Chairman, this committee has already heard significant testimony earlier in session, I believe February 3rd, 2003, an informational hearing on the lethality of strangulation in domestic violence. And, Mr. Chairman and members, what this legislation does in brief is that it makes it a felony to assault a family or a household member by means of strangulation. This is a penalty for a new crime, if you will, and the imprisonment would be for not more than 5 years or to a payment of a fine of not more than $10,000. As defined in the bill, strangulation is the intentionally impeding of the normal breathing or circulation of the blood by applying pressure on the throat or neck or by blocking the nose or mouth of another person. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women, and I would suggest and argue that it is needed because currently, in reality, it's difficult to use our current state's felony assault statute, which requires the use of a weapon or evidence of great bodily harm to charge someone at a felony level. Frankly, great bodily harm in plain English means that you have to suffer something more than a broken nose or some serious bleeding, neither of which is consistently present in the act of strangulation or in strangulation cases. Under current law, the charge, therefore, for choking someone would be, and not killing them, would be as a misdemeanor. The difference with this legislation is that immediate bodily harm is not required to charge an individual with a felony crime. As you might remember from the presentation last month, testimony was given that often the marks of strangulation do not show up right-of-way or much at all. In sum, that's the general notion of the bill, and I would like to, at this time, to get the bill in the shape that I would like, offer Amendment AO5-027 to, and ask Mr. Carlson to explain that amendment.
Okay, so do you want to move that amendment?
Yeah, I'd move the amendment.
Okay, move the amendment. Do you want to explain the amendment, Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for your record. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul here, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women. Mr. Chairman and members, the amendment that's before you is is not technical in nature, but what it does is it links up the crime of domestic assault by strangulation into the qualified domestic violence related offenses and on other domestic assaults, and so that they are consistent, and that is the total scope of the amendment. And just as a review, Mr. Chairman and members, if a qualified domestic violence related offense calls for increased penalties if there are two misdemeanor convictions within 5 years, that can be increased to a gross misdemeanor, and two convictions against the same person within 5 years can be enhanced to a felony. The purpose of the amendment is only to link up this new law with the existing law as it relates to enhanced penalties. I don't believe it's controversial.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions or comments on the amendment by the? Does the author have any comments on the amendment?
Nothing further, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion, at least on the motion to amendment 272.
Okay, so the motion is that we're going to add the AO50272 amendment, and all those in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay, the motion is passed and the amendment is on the bill. So go ahead, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, at this time, frankly, we have had testimony in a previous meeting off-site on February 3rd. Unless there's questions at this time, I would hold in reserve our testifiers, who basically would repeat much, if not all, of the same of what we've heard, and simply stand for discussion at this time.
Okay, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick, Representative Smith, I just breezing through the fiscal note, and I'm just wondering, I'm not sure who actually did the fiscal note, but what you think about the increase in prison beds. I think that, you know, I'm a co-author of the bill and support it and think it's long overdue, but I it just seems to me that this is going to be hard to prove up in court that there was strangulation. I'm just wondering how you, I'm not sure who did the fiscal note, came up with the, because it's hefty, and we're looking at 100 beds in fiscal year 06, increasing to 200 beds in 07, reaching a maximum of 200 beds. Is there, I guess from the last time we heard the bill and whatever information you provided, how we came up with that analysis?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, we are just seeing that fiscal note today and hope between now and the time we get to the Ways and Means Committee we're able to accurately reflect what we believe the true cost of this bill will be. We believe that the cost won't be as significant as indicated in the fiscal note, and that one of the reasons we hope to work with that a little bit is to have prosecutors explain to the Department of Finance how they prosecute these cases currently, which we don't think was done in the fiscal note. And so we can't really speak to the numbers as they were developed because we weren't consulted with it, but we hope between now and Ways and Means that we're able to have that fiscal note accurately reflect the cost. And we do from testimony both before this committee and in the Senate when we heard this bill last week. We think that having the statute in place will allow prosecutors and law enforcement to begin checking for the instances of strangulation, which we don't think is going on right now to the extent that it should be. So there may be some increased cost, but we don't think it's accurately reflected in the fiscal note.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the sort of the explanation, but I guess I'd still like to. I mean, are we getting fiscal notes that don't mean anything in this committee? Or I'd like to see Mr. King is here. I guess I'd like to know. I'm on Ways and Means. I guess I could wait, but I'd like to know how you came up with this analysis. I mean, this is a hefty. It's $2 million, was it?
Mr. King, do you want to come down and respond?
I guess, Mr. Carlson, too, I'm thinking, and Representative Smith, I'm thinking that most of these cases are probably going to be plea bargained down, and it's an additional tool for law enforcement and prosecutors, and a good tool. And I think it will hopefully do what we want, which is to get law enforcement to start doing a more thorough job of checking for strangulation and doing follow-up investigations, because, as you know, the marks don't often show up during the initial strangulation attempt. So all those things are good, but I just don't get where you're getting all 200 beds.
Mr. King, you're on the spot here, but you want to respond? Why don't you identify yourself and respond to the question?
For the record, I'm Jim King with the Department of Finance. Putting the fiscal note together, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission contacted a number of county attorney offices around the state to find out what the current practice is, and as far as the number of cases that were currently charged as misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors that might be charged as felonies under this case. They did get a response back from the Ramsey County Joint Domestic Abuse Prosecution Unit, and I think they contacted Hennepin County. I'm not sure they got a response from them. Anyway, Ramsey County had fairly extensive information on that, and essentially what they did here was they took that information and applied it to the number of cases statewide as far as the number of would qualify as a felony under this provision.
Thank you, Mr. King. Does that answer your question, Representative Paymar, or do you want to go farther into this?
I think someone else wants to.
There was mention of sentencing guidelines had some input into this. Do we? Would you want to hear from?
Yeah, I guess I would.
Okay, maybe we could ask Barbara Toombs to come up and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and answer the question.
For the record, I'm Barb Toombs, the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. How we proceeded on making this a fiscal note was we looked at the number of misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor domestic assaults, which totaled 5,500 last year. On information provided by Ramsey County, they were saying in the previous year they had about 15% of their cases that resulted as strangulation or would qualify as strangulation. Up to this year, which is only the first 4 months, they had about 30%. So taking the conservative estimate, we took 15% of the 5,500, which would, on the information provided by Ramsey County, qualify for the enhanced felony provision, and thus applied that to the number that we came up with. We also looked at the criminal histories and decided, based on the distribution of criminal histories between presumptive non-prison and prison beds, we applied that same percentage to the enhanced felonies and came up with the number of prison beds.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pimar.
Okay, so there were 5,500 DV cases in Ramsey County.
That's correct.
And then in 15%, there was an alleged strangulation.
Ramsey County reported 217 domestic abuse cases in 2004. 32 involved strangulation, of which 19 were charged as misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. That there was a total of 127 misdemeanor and gross misdemeanors cases. Thus, 15% of that total number involves strangulation. That is where we come up to 15% that we apply to the statewide number of misdemeanor and gross misdemeanors, which was 5,500.
Okay. Representative Tamar.
Just so, of the 15% then, did these offenders, or did Ramsey County let you know that whether these offenders had prior criminal history backgrounds or domestic violence convictions that would, I'm just thinking realistically, okay, how many of these cases are going to get prosecuted as felonies, and people and those offenders are actually going to do time in our institutions?
Representative Tamor, we assume that this new felony would be ranked at severity level 4, which is where the current domestic violence, felony domestic violence offense is ranked. Okay? At that severity level, only offenders with criminal histories of 4 or more are recommended for prison. The monitoring data indicates that 85 offenders that were sentenced for the existing felony domestic violence, so we were taking that data up, level 4, 85% of those, 85 of those offenders, 17% received executed prison sentences of approximately 25 months. We applied that same formula, the 17% with the executed prison sentence of 25 months, to this population and came up with the estimated vacancy from that.
Well,
Representative Paymar.
Final question, Mr. Chair. Then. So, Representative Smith, so between sometime this committee is going to figure out where we're going to get the $2 million to cover the Fed space, I take it.
You want to respond to Representative Paymar? Representative Smith?
I suspect that if we intend to carry this bill all the way onto the floor and pass it, then we're at that point at least going to have to know where it's going to come from, or have a better feel for the 15% figure, whether that's realistic or not, which I frankly have doubts, but can't offer any solid testimony at this point. The answer to your question, brief, is yes. We're going to have to know where the money's coming from.
Thank you.
Mr. Carter has some comments here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on the fiscal note, now this is only a preliminary note. It has not been signed up. I think the bad news is that the public defenders are not on this note yet, and I'm sure there also will have a cost.
Thank you.
Are there any other comments among committee members or questions on the bill? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a general thought and question, and maybe Representative Smith can help me. The bill is a good bill. It's needed. What concerns me is the definition of strangulation at line 13. I remember listening to the testimony and watching the movies and so forth, but nevertheless, the definition of strangulation seems to me, that's at line 13 on page 1, is really very, very broad. I don't see anything in there that we're talking about an intent to injure or intent to put someone in fear. It talks about the amount of pressure, but that could be even a light touch. My concern is, are we gonna catch somebody in a net here that really it's not intended to catch? That's just sort of a thought I have, is that the definition of strangulation is really very broad, unless it is somehow bolstered at line 9, where we've got the definition of an assault under the current statute. I'm just not sure. Can you help me with that a little bit?
We will, Mr. Chairman. Representative Newman, I'd like Mr. Carlson to give you what I hope is the answer. I'll listen to it myself and tell you whether I agree with it or not. Let's see.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Principally responsible for drafting of this legislation with the MCBW, we worked with medical examiners, prosecutors, and others, and it's our belief that on line 17, we believe that it takes care of your question, whoever assaults a family member, and then if you look on lines 9 and 10, assault has the meaning given to it in 60902 subdivision 10, which is an act done with intent to cause fear of another or immediate bodily harm or death, intentional infliction of or attempt to inflict bodily harm upon another. So you have to assault someone as it is defined in the criminal code through a strangulation. We don't think that we're picking up anybody with an unintentional conduct. It has to be an assault by strangulation.
Are there any other questions by the committee or comments? Any other one in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Smith, do you want to make any closing comments here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Senate does have a companion bill. Frankly, I think they're going further than we are and expanding it even more. So we will be very mindful before we bring it to a vote on the floor of the House that we have more ammunition, if you will, to answer Representative Paymer's question or try to address it. This act that this bill addresses to further criminalize is an act that is not often uncovered in the course of domestic abuse or domestic assault. It is a tip of an iceberg, and it's time that the tip be that the water be parted and we take a look at the whole iceberg and make sure that we have a law and laws that address the gravity of this crime. So I'm hoping that this committee and that our legislature will pass it, and that we will add to the safety of the citizens of this state. So I would again renew my motion that this bill be recommended to pass and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, so Representative Smith does renew his motion. House File 963, as amended, be passed, recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the bill is passed and re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
The next bill on our agenda today is House File 226, also Representative Smith. And so Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill and
yes, making your chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 226 be recommended to pass and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance.
Okay, the bill is before us. Why don't you present us the bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the bill before you addresses a law, parental notification law, that was passed by the Minnesota legislature in 1981. The law itself requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless parents are given 48 hours notice or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion. That's commonly called a judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be mature and capable of giving informed consent, or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, such as in the cases of abuse. This bill, House File 226, is a parental notification data bill which would allow the legislature to include in the previous law of 1981 language, if you will, that was not there, that would allow tracking, would allow the legislature to monitor how effectively the notification law is being implemented, and would enable the state to be aware of the information listed in the bill. For example, looking at the bill, it would require reporting of the number, and that would be the aggregate number. There's language that strives to keep the individual and the data private, but the number of minors or women for whom a guardian was appointed, for example, and for whom the physician provided the parent-guardian notification required by law, either in person or by mail, and how many women who were the subject of these notifications obtained an abortion from that reporting physician. Further, the bill would require the number of minors for whom a guardian was appointed. Further, it would require the physician performing to report whether the abortion was required to prevent the death, and there was insufficient time to provide notification. The abortion was authorized in writing by the person entitled notification, or the pregnant minor was the victim of sexual or physical abuse or neglect. The report would also include the number of abortions performed for which judicial authorization was received, and some additional information listed in the bill. Further, there's a provision on data restriction. Any information identifying the individual would be kept confidential by the Minnesota Department of Health, and the department's report must be presented in such a way so as to not reveal the identity of the individual. There's provisions in the bill that would require the report be made public by September 30 of each year. There are sanctions for late filing or non-filing, which would be a report filed more than 30 days late would be subject to a $500 late fee, and for each additional 30-day period. Further, if the report is not filed within a year, the Department of Health is required to seek a court order directing the physician or facility to report. And further, if the department so fails, a group of 10 or more individual citizens could petition the court for injunctive relief forcing compliance. I do have a witness that's prepared to assist in answering any questions that may be. I noticed there's also two witnesses prepared to testify in opposition to the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, that's it for the presentation.
You want to bring your witness forward first?
We're prepared for any questions if there are any.
Okay.
We have no actual presentation further than what I think.
Okay, well, if she wants to come to the table, then if you need to answer questions. Representative Damar?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith, do you have a fiscal note on your bill?
I have no fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paymer, I have none, no.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymer.
Mr. Representative Smith, wasn't this bill introduced several years ago in the legislature? I believe there was a fiscal note done at that time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, this is the first effort I've applied to this bill. I don't know the answer, but we'll see if we have one.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself and make your comments?
My name is Laura Giese. I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, this bill has been introduced in the past, and it will require a fiscal note when it gets to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want you to know that the last time that the fiscal note was prepared, it was several hundred thousand dollars that was thought that this bill would require, and probably up towards $1 million now. So we don't have the fiscal note in front of us, but this is one huge cost, and I'm wondering, Representative Smith, what the purpose of this is when we're already, we already have the 24-hour waiting period in place. What kind of information are you seeking? That's question number one. And then also question number two is, isn't this going to have somewhat of a chilling effect on judges who have to provide this information to the state?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, you have two questions. In my answer to the first one is very plainly, unfortunately, in 1981, when the legislature passed this bill, and I believe it was offered by Representative Ellehoff, Jude, Lookney, Battaglia, and Rife, at that time. Unfortunately, at that time, the bill did not include any tracking information. It didn't include any ability of the legislature to do what its function is, and that's oversee the legislation it passes to see how well it's being carried out and see what the effect of it is. The information that this data notification bill, House File 226, is seeking is again, that which information which should have been provided by a force of that bill. Basically, it is the number of minors who have sought a judicial bypass, the number of minors who have received abortions performed with a judicial by use of a judicial bypass, and I view that as number one, the legislature has the right to have that information, and number two, I think having that information is good for the legislature to know in assessing this bill for the best interests of the parents and the minor child who had that abortion. In answer to your second question, I have no idea.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kimmer.
Representative Smith, looks like you and I are doing battle here today, but I just don't normally, but I why does the legislature need that information?
Representative,
the numbers I could see, why not just have the courts submit their numbers to some state Department of Health, or to submit their numbers on an annual basis? Why go through this kind of reporting process that you're laying out here?
Representative Smith?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamer, I think the only power this legislature or any legislature has is the power to oversee what it has the authority to enact, whether that's laws restricting people from doing things, speeding, or having abortions unless it's by a judicial bypass, or whether it's in the action of the legislature to appropriate money and suggest money be spent for various line items. The legislature has the right to oversee how well or how not well its laws are being enforced, or what effect it has on the population.
I'm just trying to get the intent here. Like, what would you know over and above the numbers? I mean, are you trying to find out which judges are, through judicial bypass, are granting a minor an abortion? Are you trying to figure out which ones have the most, so there'll be some kind of public tally?
Representative Smith?
Otherwise, why couldn't the judges just submit it to the Department of Health, their numbers, and, you know, unless you're trying to actually identify the judges?
Representative Smith?
Well, the legislature, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamer, the legislature has the authority to pass the bill it did in 1981, therefore it has the responsibility to see how...
I'm not asking my question, Representative
Kamer. Representative Kamer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamer, then maybe I didn't understand your question.
I'm trying to
state it, I'll do my best to answer.
Chair, Representative Smith, I'm trying to get at why not just allow judges to submit the number of judicial bypasses that occurred and... to the Department of Health, rather than having each judge publicly identified with the numbers of bypasses that were considered in their district, thereby identifying them. Are you trying? What I'm trying to get is: are you trying to find? Are we trying to identify the judges that have grant the most abortions to minors seeking this judicial bypass?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
Representative Paymer, no, I am trying by this bill to identify the numbers, the aggregate numbers of abortions performed pursuant to the 81 law.
Representative Paymer,
Representative Smith, then why can't the judges simply provide that number to the Department of Health?
Mr. Chairman,
Smith,
Representative Paymer, again, the Department of Health cannot enforce or modify the 1981 law. It's up to the legislature, and I don't think the legislature should delegate its power to the Department of Health in overseeing the bills that it passes.
Well, Mr. Representative Paymar, I'm not going to belabor the point, Representative Smith, and I'm not going to question your motives here, but I think this is going to have a chilling effect on the court, and it provides ammunition to, and we have disagreements here in the legislature, just like we have disagreement in the state over abortion. But it's certainly going to provide ammunition to those people who are opposed to abortion to target judges based on the information that you're going to be providing out of your bill, and I don't think that that's right. I think this is just a further effort to dissuade abortion providers, to harass the court, and I think it's wrong. I don't think we should pass the bill, but the committee will do what it wants.
Okay, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, I gladly do battle with you over abortion. I think that any time that the state has state-sponsored murdering of innocent victims, we should also have a tracking of that so we can find out through statistics. Right now, we have lots of statistics in the death penalty, and everybody wants to get into those statistics to find out which ethnic group that it most advantages or disadvantages. We go over that back and forth. It seems like when we have the death penalty for innocent victims, we should at least know the tracking of how it's being administered at state expense. So I think it's a good bill.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cornish. That was a comment, not a question. Mr. Paymar, do you have another question? Or we don't need to have a tit for tat here.
No, so. I just want to make a point.
Mr. Paymar.
This is exactly why we'll never get anywhere in this legislature dealing with the issue of unwanted pregnancies and how to deal with it when we have comments like Representative Cornish just made.
Okay, Representative Johnson?
I'm going to ask a question, Mr. Chairman. Of Ms. Giese or the author, I'm trying to figure out, does this break this down by judge or is it just by counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it is broken down by counties. And so the counties, the county court administrators would report to the Department of Health.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Murphy? Fastest, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, is it typical that 10 members of the public can compel the department and to do a report and be awarded attorney's fees for a late report or for failure to report? We get late reports around here all the time. Is there anywhere else in statute where that is allowed?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, again, we'll let the testifier supply the answer, and if it's one that I agree with, I'll let you know.
Okay. Ms. Easy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, in 2003, we passed Minnesota Statute Section 145.4247. That was within the Woman's Right to Know law, and the same language was within that law.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That doesn't give me great comfort.
Mr. Chairman, as a reminder, there are two additional witnesses in opposition to this bill.
Okay, Representative Soderstrom, all set. No question. Any other questions among the committee members at this point of the bill's author and the testifier? Okay, there's, I think, a couple of people here who wish to testify on the bill. First of all, Ms. Grossman? And then and Mr. Stanley, Mr. Tim Stanley as well, if you both want to take the stand. Is Ms. Gottesman? Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes.
Ms. Gottesman, welcome to our committee. Why don't you identify yourself and make your comments?
Sure. Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Natalie Gottesman. I'm a resident of Edina. I'm a guardian ad litem volunteer in Hennepin County, and it is in that capacity that I am here to oppose House File Number 226. I'm not speaking for the court or court administration. I've been a guardian ad litem for nearly 8 years. I've been a guardian ad litem for young women seeking judicial bypasses for 5 years. During that time, I have both been very conscientious in my duties and impressed with the judges before whom I have appeared. I chose to become a guardian ad litem because of my love for children. As a mother, I worry about the future generation and have felt that being a court-appointed guardian ad litem for children who are needy affords me a way to make a meaningful contribution to enhancing their lives. Since all of you may not be fully aware of the process, I would like to briefly describe it. In Minnesota, young women who are under 18 years of age and not able to obtain signatures of both parents prior to abortion procedures are required to appear before a judge to obtain a judicial bypass. It is the judge who makes the final determination of whether the young woman is mature and mentally competent enough to make this decision. Prior to appearing before the judge, a guardian ad litem conducts an interview with the woman. These young ladies all personally make their own appointments to come to court. They come seeking judicial bypasses following their physical examination and counseling at the facility where they will be having their abortion should they so choose. We always document each young woman's date of counseling and proposed procedure date. Since the 24-hour legislation has taken effect, the young women I have seen have all been in compliance. I complete a 3-page questionnaire which asks questions regarding the young woman's general health, the counseling she was given at the facility where she will be having her procedures with regards to the process, aftercare, physician liability, and most importantly, her alternatives to having an abortion. Her reasons for feeling an abortion is her personal best choice, whether there has been any coercion relating to her decision, how long she's been thinking about her decision, why she's not informing either one or both of her parents, and if there's any additional information she feels the court should be made aware of. I also try to determine whether she has an adult who has or will be supportive of her following the abortion. And in the rare instance where she has not identified anyone, we work on how she will go about that so that I feel comfortable she will have either a trusted professional or adult in whom she can confide if she feels the need. I also am very careful to explain to each young woman that if the judge signs a bypass for her, it should be considered comparable to a parent permission slip, allowing her the freedom to make up her mind as to what she feels is best for her in this situation. I make it very clear that she is not to consider the judge's signature a court order, but merely a document indicating that the judge has determined she is mature and mentally competent to make this decision without the signatures of both of her parents. These young women all have received the requisite counseling. In the Hennepin County Guardian Ad Litem Office, our procedure is if ever it were determined that counseling had not taken place, the young woman would be sent back to the clinic. I have seen young women between the ages of 12 and 17, with the percentages increasing as the chronological ages increase. Many of these young women are 17 and approaching their 18th birthdays. They rarely arrive at the guardian's office alone. The younger women are frequently accompanied by one parent. As they get older, they tend to arrive with a boyfriend, older sibling, close friend, or counselor. The most common reasons given for choosing an abortion over being a single parent or giving up the baby for adoption are that these young women feel they are too young and not ready to take on the responsibilities of motherhood and support a child. Many have post-secondary education goals that they do not want to forfeit. They frequently tell me how important it is to them to be good mothers when they have children, and that they know they aren't emotionally or financially able to do that now. Many are the children of parents who had teenage pregnancies. They don't want to end up like their moms and can't confide that in their parents. Nearly all say that they could not imagine giving birth to a child and then giving it up for adoption. They feel that alternative would leave them with more long-lasting emotional and psychological repercussions than having the abortion. The most common reasons given for not confiding in both parents are that they don't have contact or relationship with one of their parents, one or both parents are deceased, their parents would not agree with their decision, one or both parents have chemical or psychological problems that have resulted in the young woman being their caretaker, parents have threatened to toss them out of the house if ever they get pregnant or even have premarital sex, cultural barriers, or they simply feel that they have made a mistake that they feel they should be taking responsibility for rather than disappointing their parents. Following this interview, I appear before the judge with the young woman, giving a description of her answers to my interview and my impressions. The judges, without exception in my experience, have been very professional and conscientious during these hearings. This is by no means a rubber stamping process. They always ask the young woman a few additional questions, with the most popular one being, what is their plan going forward so that they don't become pregnant again? They also repeat the instructions that their signature is not granting the young woman permission to go get an abortion, but a finding that they are competent to make their own independent decision about what they want to do. Both my interview and the judge's hearing are conducted with the young woman alone. This is so that in the event that there is any coercion going on, the young woman has two opportunities to confide that information. Court reporters record the hearings. These current procedures utilized for judicial bypass appear to me to be very appropriate and thorough. I'm at a total loss to understand what the real motivation behind and purpose are for the proposed legislation. At a time when our legislature is grappling with finding funding for so many fine existing programs, particularly in the areas of health care and education, it seems ludicrous to me as a taxpayer to be adding an additional ongoing burden to taxpayers simply for the exercise of data collecting in one additional way.
Thank you, Ms. Gottesman. Mr. Stanley, would you like to make your comments at this time?
Thank you very much.
Please identify yourself.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tim Stanley, and I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify against House File 226, the Parental Notification Data Act. I testify today on behalf of our members and Minnesota's pro-choice majority. NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota is the state's largest grassroots advocacy organization dedicated to defending the reproductive rights of all Minnesotans. NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota strenuously objects to House File 226. This bill goes way beyond what is necessary to ensure that judges and clinics are obeying the requirements of Minnesota's rigid two-parent notification law. House File 226 is an anti-choice attempt to further restrict young women's access to privacy. The U.S. Supreme Court has firmly established that minors must be given a confidential, fair, and expeditious alternative to parental notification for abortion. In Minnesota, that alternative is a judicial bypass. House File 226 requires detailed information about the number of judicial bypasses granted in each county. This is nothing more than an effort to target judges who are simply following the law by granting bypasses to young women who are sufficiently mature and well-informed, or for whom a bypass is in their best interest. Efforts such as House File 226 could further impede access to reproductive health care for young women by targeting judges who grant judicial bypasses and making these judges think twice before granting a judicial bypass to a young woman. Such a chilling effect would almost certainly unduly burden young women seeking to avail themselves of their constitutional right to choose. Regrettably, violence has struck courtrooms in Atlanta and Chicago. These attention-grabbing events shouldn't desensitize us to the sensitivity of judicial proceedings. We believe that the safety of state judges should be taken under consideration and that the legislature should do everything possible to protect the well-being of our judiciary rather than passing legislation that targets certain judges. Additionally, the bill imposes onerous requirements on abortion providers not required of other health professionals, increasing costs to both health care providers and Minnesota taxpayers. As legislators continue to introduce anti-choice and anti-privacy measures year after year, we will continue to oppose them. I ask you to reject House File 226. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley. Question of the testifier?
Of the first testifier,
actually. Okay, Representative Johnson.
All right. Actually, I just want to say one thing. I keep hearing people talk about targeting judges, and that's the reason I asked the question. The bill doesn't do that. It doesn't break this down by judge. It breaks it down by county. But I do have a question for Ms. Gottesman. Actually, two questions. How many judicial bypass cases have you been a part of as a guardian ad litem?
Ms. Gottesman.
I don't know. I would guess several hundred. I've been doing it for 5 years, and I'm available to go in one day a week, but the truth is that I don't go in one day a week because frequently there aren't any requests for judicial bypasses on the day that I'm available to go in. So, you know, and I don't track. There, on the days that I go in, there usually are between maybe one and three young women that are there. I rarely see more than three. It's usually one or two. And I'm guessing that at least 50% of the weeks I don't go in. So it's not like, I mean, this isn't like a railroad procedure. You know, I mean, they're not running them through the courts in train cars here. It's not a real busy thing, at least not in Hennepin County. It's not taken up a whole lot of time. I can only speak from my experience. But over 5 years, I would guess I've probably seen a couple hundred.
Okay.
Representative Johnson?
And Mr. Chair, again, ballpark, unless you have an actual number, how many of those couple of hundred requests do you think have been denied?
Of the ones that I presented, I know one.
The one out of what you said was several hundred?
Probably, yeah. I mean, like maybe, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, testifiers. I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Representative Smith, would you like to make any closing comments on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, no, I just renew my motion.
Okay, Representative Soderstrom has a question.
I would just like to thank Chairman Smith for bringing this forward, and I would like to ask for a roll call vote. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Paymore, any more questions?
To clarify a comment that Representative Johnson made, if you do look at Subdivision 5, Public Records 4, it does speak to the number of cases in which the judge issued an order authorizing an abortion without notification. If Representative Johnson would like to amend the bill, he might want to do that on page 5, where on line 8, where it talks about protecting the individual having the abortion, to include judges and guardian ad litems from being recorded. That might be somewhat helpful.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Representative Paymar. And that's why I asked the question, because I was looking at that same language on page 4, but I don't think what that says is it's not identifying which judges. It's a lump figure, so it's a lump sum per county. And so when they say the judge, they essentially mean all the judges in the county. At least that's how I'm reading it. So I don't think it does do what you are concerned, and I think that's a fair concern.
Seeing no other comments in the bill, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I've heard several times today, Representative Smith, the term a chilling effect. And it seems to me that to ward off the chill, that's why the judges wear robes.
Well, thank you. Seeing no further comments, Representative Smith renews his motion that House Bill 226 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health, Policy, and Finance. Roll call has been requested. Take the roll.
Vice Chair Eastland?
Yes.
Representative Cornish?
Yes.
Ellison? Hillstrom?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Nestle?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Newman?
Yes.
Tamar?
No.
Soderstrom?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
There being a tally of 8 in favor and 3 against, the motion passes, and the bill is referred to Health Policy and Finance Committee. The next bill on our agenda, Representative Smith and House File 1094.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the bill and ask you to lay it over after we present it for possible inclusion at a later date.
Thank you. The bill is before us. Representative Smith, go ahead and present the bill.
Well, I want to thank Representatives Murphy and Paymar for co-authoring this very good bill, and I hope that it will receive its due attention. This legislation, House File 1094, clarifies the definition of victim within Chapter 611A, crime victims' rights provision, expanding the term victim to include family members of a minor, an incompetent, an incapacitated, or a deceased person. Currently, victim is defined as a natural person, a corporation, a government entity, or other entity in occurring a loss or harm. My notes indicate that this is a Department of Public Safety agency initiative. Apparently there was, and I don't have the appropriate site, if one wants to know I'll have to supply it, but apparently in March of 04 there was a Supreme Court case that found a murdered victim's sister could not receive restitution because she didn't fall within the definition of next of kin under the current statute. This seems inconsistent because this particular case, I believe, was for funeral costs, and the goal of restitution is or should be to hold the offender accountable and for the total cost of the crime, and not just a cost by incurred by a closest relation. So this bill is being brought forth to clarify the definition of victim to include family members. As I previously stated, that's it in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from the committee? Seeing none, is there any comments or testifiers that would like to testify for or against the bill in the audience? Seeing none, then Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1094 be laid over for possible conclusion on the omnibus bill. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion passes and the bill is laid on the table and laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill on our agenda today will be Representative Ellison, House File 1289. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ellison. Do you want to move your bill and get it before us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 1289 this time.
Okay, the motion will be that the House File 1289 be laid over for possible consideration of inclusion in the omnibus bill. So the bill is before us. Go ahead and make your presentation of the bill.
Members, I actually come to this bill without any input from industry or the retail trade group. I, as you know, in my other life as a criminal defense attorney, I represent lots of people, and I actually had a client who, for more times than my comfort would allow, had done a gas and go. If you don't know what a gas and go is, you get the gas and go without paying. And of course, I have a professional obligation to zealously advocate for my client, and I did so. And after we were walking out of the courthouse, I said, "Why do you keep doing this?" And he says, "Because I got a great lawyer." Ha, ha, ha. And I didn't think that was funny. And so I said, "You know, you're abusing your license, and you're causing all the rest of us to have to pay more for gas and everything else." So I came down here, and I had a bill drafted, and I put it in. And lo and behold, I got a hearing. And so here I am before you today asking you to say, with me, that it's not that if you steal gas, that it's not funny, it's not a prank, it actually hurts the retailer, but it also hurts all of us who buy gas, and it makes for a whole lot of trouble, and it's why you can't pump gas late at night. If you've ever been to a gas station late at night and you've got a faraway pump, you got to pay first. Why? Because some folks like the gas and go. And I just think it's wrong, and I think that it should be more than just having to pay restitution. In fact, since you abuse your license, maybe you should lose your license for a little while. I'm hoping, and this is nothing I can make anybody do, but I'm hoping that if this bill does pass, that the retailers will buy stickers to put on the pumps to say you can lose your license for 30 days if you get convicted of gasoline theft. So I know that there are some testifiers. They came to me this week and said, "We like your bill. We want to testify on behalf of your bill." And, of course, I never turned down help. But I just want you to know that We are not in collaboration. I have my own reasons for wanting this bill, and they have theirs. And I guess it's a good thing when you can come to the same spot for different reasons. So that's all I have to say about the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, let's have the testifiers come on down. Gentlemen, go ahead and whoever wants to start, give us your name and go ahead.
Sure. Commissioner Smith, members of the committee, my name is David Bladnick, and I represent Marathon Ashland Petroleum and Super America as well. When we saw this bill, we looked at it and really appreciate someone coming forward and looking at this. And people, again, as Representative Ellison said, a lot of people look at this as kind of fun and games. I fuel and I'm gone. And what we're seeing in Super America is roughly $100,000 a month in drive-offs in the state of Minnesota. Now, we have approximately 160, 170 stations. So you're talking $600, $700 a store in drive-offs. Talk to Holiday. I was just over a meeting with Holiday stations. They're seeing somewhere in the numbers of around $50,000 a month. So between your two large chains in the state, you're talking $150,000 a month of people driving off. And, again, you know, we come back and say, yes, we'd like to be paid for our fuel. And when you come back, we're paying for the fuel. We have to pay for the taxes on that fuel. And as we go forward, we continue to see more and more. As the price of gas rises, we see more drive-offs, and again, it becomes a larger number in as far as the cost of the drive-off to us. And I think in line with what Representative Ellis is doing is that there needs to be some form of, people have to understand that there's more than just, I drove away with this product, so if I get caught, I pay for it. If I don't get caught, I made off with the product. So from that point, we would support the bill. And again, from the numbers of our losses, $150,000 a month and probably the two largest chains in the state of Minnesota per month, those are some real numbers when you look at the, you know, that's probably 300, that's 10% of your service stations in the state when there's roughly 3,000 service stations. So with that, I stand for any questions.
Any questions at this time? Representative Eastland.
I just was looking at it, and I don't know what all of these under Section 609 and all that stuff is, but would this apply to siphoning gas out of another car? Would it apply to stealing gas from my garage? I don't
think so. I need to take a tighter look at the bill, but it was intended for people who gas and go to retail outlets. And, you know, when you got people, so that's the intention. And, I actually got up here and just explained the bill without taking another review at it, because as you can see, I've been rushing pretty bad today. But the thing is that it's intended to address the retail issue. But,
Representative Ellison, you haven't been rushing pretty bad today. You've been rushing pretty good. Does anybody can help us with that, gentlemen or staff? I think common sense would mean no, but you know.
Well, that's what I thought too, but I didn't see that in the statute book.
Mr. Chair and members, the cross references to the theft statute, clause 1, which is the basic theft language, and so it probably would apply to stealing from a non-commercial source.
Mr. Chair, is there some way that maybe we could fix that so it kind of hits the target that you're really shooting at? Because I think you're both shooting at the same target here, that we're really after the drive-offs.
Representative Ellison, this bill will be around for a bit, considered for possible inclusion, so that can be worked out or addressed or not.
We'll work it out.
Okay. Additional. Representative Hillstrom.
Just while we're looking at things to address, I actually worked at a Super America gas station, the overnight shift, for a while. And one of the things that I found as a clerk is that people would come in and buy groceries and goodies and things, and they wouldn't necessarily pay for their gas. And so on the first offense, or if you have a manager who is just says, we're going to prosecute everyone, that could pose a problem. And so we may want to consider either a second offense, or we may want to have something to make sure that we aren't suspending people's driver's license who really, in all honesty, just really forgot to pay for their gas.
I actually thank you for that question. I'm sorry,
Representative.
That is the point that I actually did think about. And I can tell you that if you are ever caught with gas and go case, and you're gonna it's a misdemeanor offense, you have a right to counsel, you have a right to a trial, you have a right to cross examine, you have a right to subpoena witnesses, you have a right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you're convicted after all that, then you ought to lose your license. That's my thought.
Chairman, one other thing, and to the point, and I guess going back to one thing I guess I missed with Representative Ellison, we would actually also look at these stickers as a positive on the pumps to warn consumers that for the gas and go that it would be there. So if something along this lines did pass, we would look at putting some stickers and making people aware of the offense. And we do feel that that actually helps deter people from gas and go. We've seen a decrease in Michigan and some others where there were some laws passed, and really putting the sticker on the pumps has helped us with that. So.
Representative Hillstrom.
Oh, question. Could you let me know how many people do you think, you know, drive off and then later come back and pay and say, oh, man, I forgot to pay for my gas? Or
Mr. Blatney. Reverend Chair and Representative Hillstrom, in talking to the Super America senior management the other day on this, what they said was that it's a small number, and we're actually those that do forget and possibly drive off actually come back and pay. And again, we have no problem with that if it was a true mistake. We've had people that said, I put my credit card in, or I thought it read my credit card and I drove off. We've gone to tapes and saying that they've done that and have no problem with that. It's almost theft rings that are stealing gas. They go out, they'll get fake driver's license or license plates for their vehicles, so when you run the number, it's a wrong number, or they'll cover them up. So we see a lot of different ways that they're doing these things. Again, our position is, I think, along with Representative Ellison's, that if they truly meant to steal gas, then you should go after them. If there's a way that you can decipher through the case that it was a true mistake, and again, I think we see that being less than 5% of the cases that it was true mistakes. Again, most of those we do get paid back. Somebody goes home and realizes they didn't pay, they come back and pay us. And that does happen quite often.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Krogman or you. Did Representative Leffick have a bill like this? Similar to this in the olden days?
Chairman, Representative Mercy, yes, she did. Also heard in
the Your name for the record. Go ahead.
Yes, she did, and it was also heard in the Senate committee a couple of years ago.
And what happened with that?
It was laid on the table.
And what was the problem?
That had a longer suspension period, and the problem was a concern about taking somebody's driver's license, I think it was 6 months in that, for stealing gasoline. And they said it wasn't a large enough crime, for lack of a better explanation, to take somebody's license.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr.
Blatnick.
In the period, in the last 3 years, you said $100,000 a month you lose the Super Americas across Minnesota, or all gas stations across Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is just the Super Americas in Minnesota. We are averaging $100,000 a month in drive-offs. Now, it's gone up a little here as the price of gas goes up. We look at it in a dollar amount, not necessarily in a gallon amount. So I would have to go back and have them decipher that out into a gallon amount to see if it's changed. But the $100,000 is a monthly average that we're losing in drive-offs.
What percent of the service stations do you control, SA in Minnesota?
We have 178 service stations in Minnesota. I believe there's a little over 3,000. And the other number I gave you, the $50,000 roughly number from Holiday, they control roughly another 200. So I'm saying between the two, that's about 10% of the service stations in Minnesota.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, whenever we lift licenses, we're also depriving people of the ability to get work.
Discussion. Representative Newman.
Yeah, just a thought. It seems to me that a 30-day suspension for theft of gasoline at a retail outlet is a reasonable response, and I think you've got to be responsible for the consequences of your own act. And assuming that Representative Ellison can tighten this up so that we know we're dealing with retail outlets as opposed to stealing gasoline out of Representative Eastland's garage, I would be in support of this bill. In response to Representative Hillstrom's questions, I'm one of those folks that have driven off. And I beat the gendarmes back to the station and paid for the gas. It was a little embarrassing, I got to admit, but I've done it. So I really don't know that would be a huge problem. I think all you have to do is turn around and go back and pay for your gas, or exercise the rights that Representative Ellison has outlined.
Representative Ellison.
I'd just like to point out to members that one element of proving a theft case is intent. And if you, as the state has to prove you intended to steal the gas. Like, so for if you take the example of Representative Newman brought up, he had no intent to steal. It's just an absent-minded mistake. I drove off myself one time, too. Realized it, turned around, paid off. So if the state cannot prove that you intended to steal the gas, then there's no case, and you'd be not guilty. And I also want to mention that I did think about the period of time. And I thought to myself, 6 months, that's going to hurt somebody. That's going to mess them up. But a month of, you getting on that bus every day or having a carpool, it's going to inconvenience you enough so that you will remember it. Whereas, if you get your gas on absolute fumes, absolutely on E, if you have an average sedan, you're talking about putting, $30 into the car, $33 nowadays maybe, you pay that restitution, probably it's going to get plea bargain down to a petty misdemeanor, because if any prosecutor wanted to take me to trial on a case like this, I'd say, fine, let's take a week to go to trial on your $33 gas and go case. They're going to probably deal that case, and then it's all over for the defendant. It's all over for the person. Ha ha ha, they walk out. So in my opinion, just a little reminder, and also we take people's license for other things. I mean, driving after suspension, you're going to lose your license. Your license is going to be suspended. Driving after revocation, any DUI offense, you're going to be driving without proof of insurance, you're going to get suspension. And, in my opinion, some of these things you shouldn't have your license suspended for, but you are actively using your license to steal. In this situation, it's an abuse of your license. It's an abuse of the privilege to drive. Therefore, you should have it taken away. So, that's enough speech to find.
Mr. Clapp, did you need or want to add anything at this point?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Service Station Association. We have about 440 retail independent owner operators in the state of Minnesota today. And I just want to let you know that our association supports this bill and that Representative Ellison has put together. And with the increase of gas prices reaching around the $2 mark and expected to be into the $2.15-$2.20 range this summer, you're only going to see this be more of a problem out there. And I'm speaking on behalf of our independent owner operators. I'm going to share a few stories with you guys today, because it's just not about people just stealing gas, but it's also a safety concern on our behalf of the independent members. Is an example of our member, South France Amico, in Edina, Minnesota. She recognized the guy that stole gas from her before. She went out to stop him, and he almost ran her over. Sort of a concern there. Leroy's Auto Plaza in Bloomington, Minnesota. The guy stole gas. He put the nozzle on the ground with it running, so that way the attendant inside the store doesn't realize that the pump's hung up yet, so thinks the person's up there still getting gas. What happens is the nozzle's left laying on the ground. Now if you get into the sewer systems, now the city's going to shut down. So it's also a main safety concern. And I do know that in Florida and Ohio, they've adopted a similar practice to this. We've seen some success stories out of those two states. However, we do not have the statistics to share with you folks today on the hard numbers of what it's done to drive-offs in those states.
Questions? Any other questions? Mr. Krugman, do you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krugman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members own and operate 1,700-1,800 convenience stores and service stations around the state. I simply say I don't have anything else to add that we support the bill.
Anything further? One more question. Representative Eastland.
Maybe you could just... How much of this problem is going to eventually push us all towards prepay? I mean, a lot of stations do that now. They require prepay to avoid the drive-off question. I mean, how much of this could be handled internally in the marketplace, and is that a better solution or not?
Response.
Chairman Smith, Representative Eastland, looking at that, we actually have fought some mandatory prepay in some other areas, especially if it was city by city, because it creates kind of an unfair marketing where people have to come in. One of our concerns is that you end up handling a lot of the customers twice. And when you look at it, and a lot of people are fueling up multiple times a week, and their time is of essence. We've gone to the prepay at the pumps to try to facilitate people moving through the service stations. What you end up with is somebody wants to get gas and milk or other products inside. They got to come in and give you a credit card. You know, you have a clerk holding that credit card. There's issues with that. If people come in and prepay with cash, they give you a $20 bill. They only got $16 worth of gas. They have to come in and get changed. Again, you end up handling all the customers twice. Something along this lines, you know, still doesn't go to that point. If you continue to have a large problem with drive-offs, you can go to prepay. Again, it generally tends to be a marketing issue in a general region versus one store. And the problem is a lot of times you actually have a thought process behind going to prepay, that you're in a, you know, you're in a unfamiliar neighborhood from the perspective of, I have to prepay, so I'm not in the best neighborhood. And that's not always true. It's put out there because of the location of the pump. And I guess we'd like to stay away from prepay, especially from people having a, you know, coming through the state, understanding what that means as far as the demographics of where they're at.
Anything else? Representative Ellison, thank you. We'll lay the bill over.
Thank you.
There's nothing further today. This meeting is adjourned.